Hi guys, good morning, afternoon, night, evening, wherever you're listening to this episode, and welcome back to Teachable Psych. My name is Sarah Jang, your host, and this month's episode features guest Dr. Matthews, an assistant professor community area of psychology from University of Virginia. Her work primarily focuses on the processes during adolescence and emerging adulthood, drawing from theoretical and methodological approaches in education, psychology, and African American studies. I hope you guys enjoy this episode, and I'll see you at the end.
My name is Dr. Channing Matthews. I am an assistant professor at the University of Virginia in the community psychology area. The work that it focuses on ethnic racial identity and critical consciousness development of youth of color. So basically that means like, how do youth of color grow up to understand what their race or ethnicity means to them? And then what's the meaning behind those two things? And then that critical consciousness is the idea of, you know, when I see a social inequality, what happens after I become aware of it? Do I believe I can make a change? And if so, do I take action to do so? So I look at those things in relationship to a few things. So academics, civic engagement, and activism. So I think that's pretty good introduction of me.
Yeah, thank you. So can you explain why you chose this area of study and what inspired you?
Yeah, so when I was in college, I knew that I wanted to go to graduate school, but I wasn't really sure in what. And so I decided that I didn't want to go right away. So I went and worked abroad in both the Dominican Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo. And I was a teacher. So I taught eighth graders and 10th graders in the Dominican Republic. And then I taught 7th grade, 9th grade, 11th and 12th grade. And I was also a varsity soccer coach while I was living in the Congo. And what I noticed across both of those contexts was that I used both my knowledge of education and psychology to work with my students and a lot of my students to the United States to do really understand some of the ways in which they were going to be seen as like a person of color or Black in ways that they aren't seen that way in the current context they were in. So that just made me think about like, you know, what are these developmental processes of understanding what it means to hold a certain race or hold a certain ethnicity, and how does that change across the context that we live in? So that's kind of how I started.
Well, it's so cool that you got to teach abroad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So this is a broad question, and you can take it however you like. So how do you think education and psychology are correlated or connected with each other?
Yeah, well, I mean, my practical experience, I had to use the two together a lot. So just in being a teacher, you know, understanding, I taught teen across like the trajectory of being a teenager, right? So I would get them around 7th grade. So you're like, you know, 10, 11-ish up to 18 in some cases. And then in college, I was teaching, when I was a graduate student, I was teaching, you know, undergraduate students who were in this kind of emerging adulthood space. And so I think having an understanding of like how the brain develops and the decision making that that adolescents are struggling with at that time was really helpful for me to have context for why something that maybe didn't seem as devastating to me might be devastating to a teenager, or something that I felt like I could step through that a teenager was struggling because they're still kind of developing in their decision making. And part of my role was to help support that development. So I think that education and psychology walk together quite a bit. And then you know, the other thing about being a teenager is that you're really grappling with these questions of identity. So who am I? Who do I want to be? What do I want to do? What is my contribution in the world? Those are all questions that you're asking yourself a lot in being a teenager. And so, you know, part of that questioning happens in schools, because in schools, you're being asked to set a foundation to send you to college in some cases, or send you to other spaces, depending on what trajectory you want to take after high school. But in school, it's socializing you to think about what are these other trajectories that you might take. So those are active questions that you're asking, and that's all psychology when you're thinking about identity development.
Yes. So if you remember, what was your earliest research on?
My earliest research. Wow. My earliest research. So I think, you know, I think the reason I'm kind of pausing on this question, because I was like, I mean, I think I've always asked questions as a kid. Like, I've always wanted to know, like, I identify as a Black woman. So I always wanted to understand, like, what does it mean to be Black? And I think that, so in some ways, my research started when I went to a school that I was the only like Black kid in, and it was so interesting how other people had these stereotypes of who I was based on me being a Black kid versus like who I saw in my community and in my life at home. And so that set me on this journey of like, well, I want to read about all these different people who are seen as like really Black and figure out, you know, what does this thing mean? So like, I call it my summer of like Black awakening when I was in seventh grade. And I like read, I had just finished seventh grade. I was going into eighth grade, and I read like The Color Purple, Roots, the autobiography of Malcolm X, and a couple of other like really intense books to kind of just understand like, well, how is Blackness like defined? So I would say like informally, that was probably my first like research. In terms of my earliest research, like formal research, I would say that was when I was a college student at Duke. I participated in this program that was like it's almost like a service learning course. And as a part of the course, we developed a research project. And so my research project was done in conjunction with an organizing group in Charlotte, North Carolina, called the Charlotte Help. And it was, I think the HELP stood for Helping Empower Local People. And basically what I was trying to understand with them is that why were there differences in the ways that Black and Latino communities like saw each other? Like why wasn't there some communication, or why wasn't there more unity between the two groups? Because in my eyes, I was like, I think that there's some similar experiences, marginalization, but it seems that these two groups are very much pitted against each other, particularly in that context. So I talked to a lot of community leaders, interviewing them across like both sides, to be like, you know, what is it about this group or about this relationship between these two groups that makes things difficult? Like, why isn't there more communication or more unity across those groups? So that was probably my first like real foray into, you know, research.
Do you remember what the results were?
Yeah, I mean, they actually ended up getting published. So basically I don't remember all of the themes that were identified, but there was perception, and I would say that they were false. There were some perceptions that Latino groups were like taking jobs from Black people. And then there were also there's language barriers, right? Talking to these different groups. And then in terms of like where location-wise, I think I recall, and I would have to go back to the report because I haven't seen it in a while, but essentially, like, you know, there were some movement into Black neighborhoods, like historically Black neighborhoods. And so there were some tensions as a result of Latino groups moving into historically Black neighborhoods in the Charlottesville, like Mecklenburg area. So that was kind of, you know, a point of tension. And then there was also few opportunities for the two groups to come together to discuss issues on the same page. So there just wasn't a lot of opportunities for connection between the two groups, both structured and unstructured opportunities. So I think those were generally the themes that I found. You know, people don't have like this larger understanding of, you know, the marginalization that I'm experiencing is also shared with you. And so there wasn't like spaces to have many conversations around that kind of work.
So as you stated, your primary focus is on Black and Latinx youth. Once you gather your results, do you compare it to previous studies of white children or any other races?
I generally do not look at like the experiences of white children, nor do I like compare Black and Latinx experiences to white children, because I don't like to push the narrative that, you know, seeing whiteness as being normal, right? So the idea is the within group experiences of Black children, as well as the within group experiences of Latinx children, are valid enough to just look at them either individually, like as one group, or separately, right? And the reason why sometimes I'll look at them as a collective group is because even though they do both groups have unique experiences of marginalization, there are some significant overlaps, particularly if you talk about like Afro-Latino groups. And the other, you know, aspect of it is that they have experienced similar paths of marginalization, even though, like, you know, slavery is not the same as like having, you know, immigration issues or challenges around immigration. But they do have unique experiences, but they also might have similar experiences of marginalization that that will give us insight in how we think about working with these two groups, you know, in spaces such as education.
So you primarily focus on adolescence and emerging adulthood. So how does your research differ between the two? Or is it similar?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that I do. So I look at both like adolescence in high school, sometimes in middle school, but mainly in high school, and look at emerging adults, which is like 18 through 22, usually college age samples. And so sometimes the research differs in terms of what are the types of questions, excuse me, that I'm asking. You know, when you're a teenager, for example, you're not necessarily going out to vote, but there are other ways that you can be like politically engaged. So I might ask different questions about like, how are you engaging or letting people know about issues that you care about? So how do you talk about climate change? Or how do you talk about, you know, things like Black Lives Matter? Or how do you talk about, you know, the events of January 6th? So I ask different questions to make sure that it's age appropriate in terms of understanding their engagement. And then, you know, in emerging adult populations, I might be specific to like, what is your experience in this college context? Because college is quite different than high school. So I might ask specific questions relative to their college context, if they're going to a school at a predominantly white university, or if they're going to like a historically Black college or university, I might ask questions that are specific to that type of context. But in general, that my research is trying to look at like longitudinal change over time, which is essentially saying like when you start in high school, how do you change all the way up until you get to college? So some of the questions actually are the same, because I just want to see if the pattern stays the same as you get older, or if something changes as you grow older.
Did you see a difference of before and after COVID, or was there none?
A difference in terms of before and after COVID. So a difference in what exactly?
anything that was noticeable or that came up in your results?
So I haven't, like, in terms of the research that I've done, I haven't really done much on the racial identity piece in terms of before and after COVID, to have, like, because all of that data is kind of starting to come out now. What I've done work on is thinking about, like, how students are engaging, like, science literacy and things like that before, like, during COVID. And so one of the findings from that study was that students that actually were having, like, a hard time deciphering, like, between what's true and not true when it came to COVID-based information. And so that study had did not was not just focused on, like, Black or Latinx youth, just youth who were involved in a STEM program, but even that group of students was having a hard time deciphering what was going on in during COVID, in terms of, like, what was the information that was right versus what was the information that was misinformation. And that the level of literacy also depended on how much they trusted the president of the country at the time. So if it was a study that looked at both the US and the UK. And so former President Trump was in at that point, and then I think the prime minister was in the UK was Boris. I don't remember his full name, but I was able to show that higher trust in these government leaders led to less literacy in, like, being able to decipher scientific information. So that's really the only COVID study that I've really done. But in terms of, changes that have gone on, like, the biggest one that I think is coming out now is that people are really trying to understand, like, how identity is shaped within social media context. And we were very dependent on social media and, virtual media during COVID. So there are some ways in which identity is being shaped and was shaped uniquely in that space during that time that I don't think has been well captured, because everybody was kind of scrambling during COVID to figure out, well, how do we even do research in the first place if we can't, like, bring participants in or, send them surveys or whatever the case may be. So I think that that's probably a big question that is emerging now in the research.
So, what's the primary way that you gather research? Is it like you go out to public events and whoever comes up and is willing to participate, or do you send like surveys out to certain schools?
So in terms of recruiting for the research, so I'll do multiple things. So one, I will try to build a relationship with a school that might be interested in working with me on some of the questions that I'm asking. And then I also try to ask the school, like, what kind of questions do you need, want to know, that would be helpful to figure out, like, how to improve whatever school outcome. So I try to do a both and there. I use a service where you can submit, like, surveys, and they also find your participants for you, for better or for worse. So sometimes you don't always know, like, what's the quality of the data, but, like, sometimes it does help to just have panels of people who meet the requirements that you want, and they'll fill out the survey, and then you have all of this, like, quantitative data to work with. I'll also recruit, like, just on campus. So I might have, like, some flyers or something around, and we'll have my contact information. If people are interested in signing up, they can sign up, and then I'll proceed to do an interview with them, or one of my graduate students might do an interview with them. We have done recruitment through, like, social media. One of my graduate students has an Instagram account for one of the studies that she's running, and so we recruited students to come and talk to us through that. So there's lots of different ways to get different participants involved, depending on the type of audience you're trying to target.
So, how do both ethnic, racial identity, and critical consciousness promote STEM orientation?
Yeah, so I mean, that's the question that I'm constantly pursuing, but essentially, that hasn't been looked at very much. We know in general that both ethnic racial identity, like a positive relationship to your ethnic racial identity, as well as awareness of inequity, have been shown to have better outcomes in general for academics with youth of color. But it actually hasn't been investigated very much specific to like STEM outcomes or STEM orientation. So I look at high school students, most of them are not going to be doing engineering, but they do have science, technology, and math. So what I'm trying to do is really see if, do these things help you to think about or apply STEM-based or lessons in your life, or does it make it more meaningful for you? So that's one piece that I'm, you know, currently unpacking, and I actually don't really have findings to share for you just yet, because it's one of the things that my lab and I are currently working on. Both have, you know, a good affinity to their ethnic racial group, but also perceive higher levels of inequality are more likely to continue persisting, like despite seeing barriers in STEM. So they might see that, you know, their role in a STEM space is an inequity. So they might be more ready to persist, so in spite of the barriers that they see. So that's kind of some of the emerging research, but it's still kind of a question that I'm pursuing in this work.
So in your 2019 publication, Mapping the Intersections of Adolescence, Ethnic Racial Identity, and Critical Consciousness, could you explain the two processes you utilized and how it might influence one another to positive developmental outcome among youth of color?
Yeah, so that publication was basically suggesting that there are several ways in which ethnic racial identity and critical consciousness can overlap. So one of the ways is that when you student experiences some sort of discrimination, they might use a component of critical consciousness called critical reflection to kind of process that event and try to really think about, okay, I'm aware of an inequity, like what does this mean? And if it's an inequity that's related to their race or ethnicity, it might cause them to explore why would somebody see my Blackness or my Asianness or my, you know, even like a Muslim, like even like a religious discrimination, why would this be something that would be associated with like my skin color, right? And so that might prompt them to explore, like, what does my race or ethnicity mean? And what does it mean to me? And what does it mean to others? So that was one way. The other way that I talked about in that article was thinking about how if you know, in that process of exploring your identity or understanding yourself within a specific context, so, and what we might call like a politicized identity, if you understand your identity as something that is related to, you know, supporting marginalized groups or supporting activism and change, you might be more likely to be involved in what we call critical action, which is, you know, activism to create social change. And so if you understand that as a member of your particular ethnic group, that a part of your identity is rooted in social change, then you're probably more likely to be involved in social change in the future. So that is another space in which ethnic racial identity and critical consciousness might overlap. And then, you know, just understanding, like, if you like your group and you're seeing that these bad things are happening to your racial group, you might be motivated to protect them, right? And so what are the ways in which you're going to do things to help challenge the inequities that you see around you related to this group that you love and care about? So I think those are just different ways in which we're trying to tease out, like, maybe this is something that overlaps in the lives of these youth.
That's very cool. So what theoretical and methodological approaches do you most utilize for your studies?
So theoretically, I draw on two frameworks, well, maybe three. So theoretically, I use the multidimensional model of racial identity. So that one is generated by Sellers and colleagues, and they basically created what's called a content model of racial identity. And they said that, you know, racial identity is not just one thing, it's many things. And so these are the different dimensions that it's made up of. So some of it has to do with your belief systems. Some of it has to do with context. Some of it has to do with how other people see your racial group. Some of it has to do about how you feel about your racial group. So all of these dimensions inform the, you know, what you, how you understand your race. So it's known as a content-based model. So that's one that is a big influence. And then the other one is critical consciousness and socio-political development, which are not exactly the same, but they're related. So critical consciousness theory basically says that, you know, we first make the step to be aware of any sort of inequity, some sort of social inequity. So it doesn't necessarily have to be race. It could be to socioeconomic status. It could be to gender, all of these different things. And then what beliefs do I develop around, can I do anything about this inequity? And then what are the actions that you take to actually make that social change? And so socio-political development is very similar to that overall structure of thinking about critical consciousness, with the exception that it also thinks about what opportunities do you have to actually engage? Like, what are the institutions or the people or the different environments that actually give you space to think about these things and also to implement the change that is possible? Because if you don't have the opportunity to make any change, then is actual change going to happen? So those are the theoretical frameworks that I draw upon most often. And then in terms of methodology, so I'm primarily a quantitative scholar, but I use a lot of surveys and statistical modeling to show patterns of how groups of people behave or how they think. But I also use some qualitative approaches to kind of do a deeper dive into, you know, why do people do or experience the world in the ways that they do. So I've done both interviews, I've done focus groups, I have done surveys, I do a lot of statistical modeling. Yeah, so those have been my primary modes of working.
It sounds like a lot.
It is a lot. You're right.
Okay, and lastly, what research studies results fascinate you the most?
Of my own or of in general?
Your own.
In general. What research says? I mean, there's just like so many to choose from. So I think one that I'm thinking about a lot right now is I have several colleagues who do work on like thinking about critical racial consciousness or being aware specifically of racial inequities. And what they're finding about teenagers is that teenagers are more likely to hold multiple beliefs about like the origins of racism, right? So a lot of students think it's just like this one-on-one discrimination thing, and this only happens with one person who has terrible ideas about my racial group. And this is not something that's general to everybody, but this is this one time this person really messed up and really hurt me, right? But it's a harder jump for sometimes for teenagers to think about, well, what is structural racism look like? What does it mean that when I read my textbooks or I walk down the hallway that I don't see any scholars that look like me? Or when I'm reading books or I'm in an English class that I don't read any books by like Black or Asian or Latino authors. Like I'm only the canon or the curriculum is all white authors. So, you know, sometimes teenagers actually don't see that kind of stuff. They're just like, well, this is just what it is. And so, but they're working these things out at the same time. But also sometimes they're like, well, I think this is true. I think this individual thing happens. And then I also think that these structural things happen, but I don't know how to resolve these two things. So I think that those findings have been interesting to me because, you'll see some people, there's some students who are like, well, I think that my group can be perceived as really lazy, right? But they're also like, but I also experience discrimination, and they're trying to resolve this conflict that they're seeing. But it's not, you know, it's fascinating to me that teenagers are really grappling with these things. And so what I've been interested in is the ways that different scholars have been highlighting that teenagers are very complicated in how they're deciding about what is racism, what is not, and like, how does it function in society? And so that's kind of, those are the findings that have been really interesting to me because they've been really showing that, you know, teenagers are very dynamic in their understandings of the world, and they are very different from how many adults understand the world. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking time, Rudy, to do this. Hi guys, and welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode of Teachable Psych. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and gained some valuable insights. And before I wrap things up, I want to take a moment to wish each and every one of you a Merry Christmas. Whether you're celebrating with family, friends, or even if you're just enjoying some quiet time alone, I hope this holiday season brings you joy and warmth. And as I close out this year, I want to express my gratitude to all of my listeners. Your support means the world to me, and I can't wait to bring more engaging content in the coming year. And if you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe to Teachable Psych so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to follow me on social media at Teachable_Psych. From Teachable Psych, I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And until next time, take care and happy holidays.